Stephen Rick.
Timothy Elliott. I haven't called you Timothy for a long time, actually.
Nobody's called me Timothy for a long time. No. Only the official people, like tax people and accountants and bank people.
Them ones that come in a brown envelope.
Brown envelope people call me Timothy, and I go, oh.
The brown envelope sector.
The brown envelope sector. But we're not talking about things that make us sad today, because we've got... Because we've got Jenny Lothrop back in the house. I say back in the house because she did a rebite with me in the previous incarnation of the podcast about Agile, because she's an official Agile working coach and an official happiness coach. And she does stuff for Visit Peak District. And she runs a co-working place in Matlock. And she's a travel blogger.
Pretty remarkable.
That's a lot of things.
Yeah.
That is a lot of
pretty
things.
Pretty remarkable.
But she just does everything in, like, in such a good way. Like, everybody needs a bit of Jenny's kind of outlook in life and enthusiasm and energy. So I presume we'll cover a bunch of stuff today, including how to find joy and happiness in the work you do, which is probably useful for a few people. I imagine listening. Like, a good 7 out of 10 listeners will be super happy with that.
I'm one of those. That would be lovely. It'd be great to understand how to be happy in your work.
Yeah, it would. It would. I bet those guys at Bank.io are pretty happy, though, because they're pretty remarkable. Let's hear from them now. Hey, it's Tim. It's no Steve here. So I'm just popping on to let you know, this show is brought to you by Bant.io, the all-in-one B2B lead generation toolkit designed to automate your customer acquisition. Please take the time after listening to this amazing episode to check out all the links and information in our show notes. Okay, Mr. Rick, we're back with another guest, another remarkable human to talk to today.
Yes, looking forward to this one. It's going to be very interesting on how we can be happy in our life and in our jobs.
Yeah, so let's start there. In fact, we'll get her to introduce herself. Jenny, why don't you say hello to the people and tell people what you do and all about you?
Hello to the people listening. So I'm Jen Lothrop, whatever you want to call me. And I do a bunch of stuff. So I run an organisation called Feel Good, Do Good, which is all around making organisations happier and doing work better. And it encompasses a wide range of things, happiness and wellbeing training, agile working, which I believe is a happier way of working, and a lot of kind of digital stuff. So working on digital projects, digital strategy, bits of digital marketing, all kinds of things. I mainly work with charities and public sector organisations and some SMEs. I also run a co-working space called Co-working Corner in Matlock in Derbyshire. It's very small. It's been open 3 months. And we're about doing work better and being happier here too. So that's good. And then I am also a trustee for the Peak District National Park Foundation. So I guess that's about making the planet happier, or our national park happier, or helping people be happy by going to our national park. I'm adding happiness in there as much as I can. But I do a bunch of things, always got my, involved in lots of different projects and all sorts of stuff. But that's kind of a bit of an overview of what I do.
That's a good bunch of stuff, actually.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. That's probably like half of it, really. I could go on, but I'm like, I can't spend the whole podcast just introducing myself.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I sometimes worry if I'm a jack of all trades, but I like to think that that's a good thing these days.
Do you know what? I think in work, especially if you're not like an employee of a job, right? I think kind of variety and the ability to be kind of curious and explore a few opportunities is one of the big reasons why people make that shift, right? It's because I have the same issue. In theory, on paper, if you look at a CV, I could have, I don't know, let's be polite and say 10 specific job titles where I could make a living from. But as soon as I stick a label, right, I'm like, oh, he's going to be a brand strategist. I go, yeah, but I'm also all of this stuff. I feel job titles and labels a bit of a constraint in my work happiness. Anyway, they seem to have the opposite effect.
I feel exactly the same, and I find that I change my LinkedIn profile, what my title on there as to what I do a lot, often depending on if I've put a proposal in. I'm like, oh, I put a proposal in and my LinkedIn says I do this, but this proposal's about this other thing, so maybe I should change my LinkedIn profile. But trying to encompass it all is hard, and I'm always trying to kind of find ways. So I think the tagline of making organizations happier, doing work better, I try to make everything in some way link into that, but it's quite broad, right? Doing work better, being happier, like they can encompass all kinds of things. So that's how I try and wrap it together. But I also really want to do, am doing and want to do more around kind of sustainability, which I think everyone should be and is in many ways. So sometimes I guess that links with happiness too. Yeah. It's hard though. I'm not a big fan of job titles. I've just recruited someone to help at the co-working space through the government's Kickstart scheme, and I basically just asked her, what do you want your job title to be? It can be whatever you want. I don't really care. You can call yourself the director if you want, for me. But it's interesting. Titles there.
Yeah, it's
old-fashioned, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's... like when I, a couple of years ago, when I was working for an investment company, we were hiring teams in all the people they invested in and stuff like that. And it was a lot of people's first jobs or second jobs out of uni, like the first proper thing, right? The first step in a career. And they were all like, we were always like, well, you know, what do you want to, what questions do you want to ask us? And I'm like, well, what's my job title? And we were like, I don't care. What do you want it to be? Like, otherwise, can we be marketing manager? I was like, if you like, as long as you do these things, I don't really.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly.
As long as you do it, like, are responsible for these things, I am happy to call you whatever you like.
And when people get too tied into their job titles, they can be a bit kind of like, oh, well, that's not my job. And that's not. You don't really want that, whether you're a freelancer or an employer or anything. It's with any job, I think there's always going to be an element of random things that come up that you need to do. So you don't want it to be too restricting.
I agree. I do think the corporate sector's made it harder for people on that front. You know, things like job descriptions and job titles. You know, job titles are there for societal needs, whereabouts you are in your training, your understanding, and job descriptions, you know, they do hold up in a court of law if you're asked to do things outside of your job description, etc. And actually, there's a lot of corporates that have tried to contain people's creativity and actually ask them to stay within inside boxes, and that's why they're so apparent. In job titles and things, and it does work against creativity, but it does work in some respects for some industries. You know, when you start asking head of sales about marketing questions, or a marketing head of marketing about sales questions, they know bits of, but they don't know the exacts of, and if you're setting somebody's targets against those things, it could be problematic.
There's an interesting move at the moment to around kind of inclusive recruitment, and lots of places. I was someone that I'm working with at the moment was involved in an interview panel, and rather than sending in CVs and writing cover letters, they just had to answer 3 questions, and it was kind of done blind as to whether you chose to interview them just on their answers to these 3 questions. And I think it's quite an interesting way of doing it, and I can kind of see the benefits for and against. So I'm not quite sure where I stand, kind of somewhere in the middle, because I think it is really useful to understand people's experience. Where have they worked before? What kind of things have they done? But then at the same time, you could just end up getting lots more of the same people. And if you kind of just wait for the answers to the 3 questions and you get more creativity from people and they still have the opportunity to share experiences. Yeah, I don't know.
I think
define you.
Pardon?
What you've done before shouldn't define you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I think recruitment's an interesting place, actually. So Steve, I don't know if you talked to Steve or met Steve before, but Steve's background and current ground, if that's the right phrase, is in kind of skills and young people development and digital skills and products to do with that. I'll let Steve explain properly because I've probably butchered that. but he's in that world, and I'm doing a bit of work with a couple of local schools through the Enterprise Advisor scheme to help them develop career strategies based around a thing called Gatsby Benchmarks. Link will be in the show notes if people want to know what that is. But about, rather than teaching people at school to pass exams and that being the end of the successful journey, they're now looking beyond into like the productivity of that person, right? How they get into work, how they're, you know, how often they change, like real career development, like real things. And a lot of the work, like that my bit is focused on, is around finding a job that you're good at, right? Finding a job that you enjoy, finding a job that can make you happy, because it's a big lump of your life working. Right. So I'm definitely of the opinion that you should do stuff you love and try and monetize it rather than do stuff for money and try and live kind of on the outside of it. But I think that what we class as work, like, and we as in people, from people just entering the workforce to people at kind of my end of looking to get out of the workforce in the next kind of decade, maybe, is like unlearning what work means, and especially how that affects identity and happiness.
It's interesting though. There's been a quote that's been doing the rounds on social media, I've noticed, the last few days, and it was something like, is it because we're all doing what we love that we're all so burnt out? And I had an interesting conversation. I mean, I'm like you, a big believer of, you know, work being enjoyable, doing what you're passionate about, doing making sure it matches your values and beliefs and all that kind of stuff. But then I had a conversation with my friend about it, and it was like, she was like, I do have a lot of friends who just have jobs that they don't really like, but they go to work, do their job, come home, and then have a great life and seem really happy. So it's interesting. Like, it's quite, yeah, I don't know. It's like the new way of work is you've got to do what you love, you've got to enjoy work. But is it possible for everyone to enjoy work? Because there are always going to be jobs that people don't want to do, maybe, and they do because they need a job, or I don't know. It makes you think, I guess, from the other side. Yeah,
I think we're very fortunate, aren't we, that these days choice is in abundance. You know, there are new jobs out there that we would never have even known about 20, 30 years ago, and we can all work from this little machine that's on a desk inside your house, where 30, 40 years ago, you couldn't do that. You had to go to a workplace. Nothing was based around computers as such. It was more manual labor, or it was all in your head and putting it onto pieces of paper. And I think these little tiny things in phones and computers have changed everything. And I mean everything.
Yeah.
They have changed the way that the human mind is developed in what work is.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's really, we've got to remember that they're only going to, that when we talk about technology accelerating so quickly, that means job changes and job cultures are going to change just as quickly as well. It's a really interesting point that you made around, you know, some people just go to work, come home and have a happy life, whereas the people who follow their thought process and their creative styles, how they can have a more nuanced look on what work is, because their mind never switches off. You know, if we think back 10, 20, 30 years ago, where somebody would have said to me, what are you going to do for a living? I'd have just gone, I'm going to do whatever my mum and dad did. You know, there's that whole thing of those industries around Newcastle and the Tees area, or around the Birmingham area, where you would go and work in the factory where your parents used to work, and there'd always be a job there for you, but they're not there anymore. So if your work is based from your current location, which is often your home, you need to be passionate about it, for me. Yeah. Otherwise, because you've got to be able to want to get up and do the job rather than just get up to do the job.
Yeah, no, that's very true, especially, working from home a lot and being on your own. I was speaking to someone this morning who I've been off for a couple of weeks, and I normally catch up with her kind of a couple of times a week. And her manager has also been off. And so she was like, oh, I've definitely realised that I need some kind of external accountability and like talking to people, because I've really struggled without having that for 2 weeks of actually getting stuff done. Which is kind of a separate thing, I think, because I think she does enjoy her job, but you sometimes need that kind of extra support or accountability and human interaction. Like, we've got everything on our laptops and we can do everything sat at home on our own. And it's the reason I opened my co-working space. Is before the pandemic, I used to go into people's offices for work quite a lot, and did some contracts where I'd be commuting to London or the Lake District 1 or 2 days a week. And I used to moan about the commute, but actually when I was at home 5 days a week working, I found it quite hard, because I'm definitely an extrovert, and I think even introverts need human interaction. And setting up my co-working space was that way of meeting other people, working with other people, and also having some accountability, because even though everyone that works here does completely different things, we actually kind of help hold each other accountable. It's kind of, you know, I've got a big deadline today, got to focus, and they'd be like, right, come on, I've got a deadline too, let's do it, let's do some Pomodoros, or let's, you know, do different productivity techniques together and get stuff done. And I know that if I was at home on my own, I'd probably get a bit more sidetracked and not focus as much. And yeah, so it's both sides. You need to love what you do, but you also need, still, even if you're the most passionate person about your job, I think you still need some kind of external accountability or support alongside it.
You mentioned a couple of interesting things there, right? So, And in your introduction, you mentioned agile, which might lead us into that sort of conversation, right? So when you're working with an organisation on organisational happiness, for want of a better phrase, right, what's been the change, or what role does the digital workplace play in organisational happiness, do you think?
Do you mean in terms of now that everyone's remote and
a bit of everything? So that included, but also you can get software now in organisations, right, that in theory are employee engagement tools or culture driven tools, right? whether to manage kind of connection, and people might even just work on comms like Slack, right? Or,
yeah.
or Jira or anything. Like, what's the, has there been, has, is there more, as we automate processes and things get, in theory, technologically easier, digitally easier, does that leave us more room in our workday to be, like, to do human stuff, ergo, therefore make us happier? Or is it, like what's the relationship there? A bit of a broad, open-ended
thing
you can take.
So I think it's different for everyone as to what works best for them. And I think, you know, I've used things like Jira in the past, which work really well with certain teams, particularly like development teams, where you can add in all the detail and they want the detail to know what they're doing, and you move the tickets and that kind of stuff. And Trello, use Trello quite a lot in kind of a more basic version of, I mean, Jira and Trello are linked now, but a more basic version of kind of like a Kanban board of what we're doing, what's in the backlog, what we're doing this sprint, what's needs testing, that kind of thing. But it's funny because I think you've had to use that over the last year and a half, 2 years because of the pandemic. But in the past, I've definitely seen, I want to say, more joy maybe from the physical in-person stuff. So when you actually have a Kanban board on a wall with post-its or little cards and you're moving them across the wall, and you have your morning stand-up where the whole team comes in a circle and stands next to the wall, and you move, you, like I did this yesterday, and you move it from in progress to done. And I just think there's still, you get that kind of dopamine hit, feels stronger than when you're just moving a digital box across on a Trello board or on a Jira board. So yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily saved time. I guess it's easier. It's easier for more people to be there or get involved or share a screen on Zoom or that kind of thing. But I still love an actual physical board and actual post-its. And yeah, I guess things I've used the last year and a half, I've used Mural a lot. Mural is my go-to, and a client of mine uses Miro, which is very similar, but I much prefer Mural. And I use it quite a lot for training now as well. So rather than having a PowerPoint, I will like whiz people around the Mural board, and you have kind of the sections and you can see people writing post-its at the same time. But I also love that you can do kind of incognito. So if you don't want to just be copying what everyone else is writing when they do an activity, you kind of turn it incognito as if you're sat around a table writing on your personal post-it notes and then share them on the wall together. So I do quite like that.
Everybody or every organisation that I've spoken to about the last couple of years, right, we might mention the C word, but it's like have missed stuff like serendipity and coffee breaks. Like, not work, like work has been work, right? They've done the job, they've delivered the work, sometimes even more productively, I would say, right?
Yeah.
In certain circumstances. But part of that thing where they're unlearning what work means to them, and they're, you know, their its role within their life and their things like their identity with it and stuff like that, it's come from, it's part of that because it's doing the job, the tasks they have to do to get their job done, right, is not as much related to the human element. You just happen to be all working under the same banner, right, or for the same project. Like, but the connection bit, the human connection bit, right? The bits in between doing the task seem to be the bits that make work valuable, and maybe they bring in words like culture to the happiness and things like.
In It's been interesting, like, the different ways organisations have dealt with it. And, I mean, one of the key words that I use a lot in agile training and happiness is autonomy and trust. And they're, like, the key things. And I think some organisations have done that really well over the last couple of years, and some have done it really badly. Like, I don't know if you've seen these kind of viral posts on LinkedIn and stuff. I mean, I haven't heard any first-hand accounts, but of people that have been told to keep their video on the whole time they're working from home, and their managers can watch them whenever they want, and, like, freaky things. You've got to check in online every 15 minutes or log everything you've done and stuff like that. That's not going to make someone happy. People, you get that dopamine hit when you're ticking things off, when you're showing people that you've completed stuff. And there is definitely that side of sharing and showing what you've done, which is, again, kind of with morning stand-ups, with, like, Kanban boards in Agile, of, like, moving things across, and it's sharing and everyone can see that, and you're telling everyone what you're doing. So you've got that kind of sharing side and kind of support for each other and feeling of accomplishment. But then you've got to, at the same time, give them the autonomy and trust to get on with it how they want to do it, and not kind of overwatch and micromanage. Or, and I think some organizations have just done a terrible, terrible job of that over the last year. And if we think about happiness and what makes people happy at work, those two things are really important. They want autonomy and they want trust, but at the same time, they still want some kind of direction. They want to know what they're doing. It's like when you think of, when you get stressed about a piece of work, it's often because you're not quite sure how to do it. And as soon as you actually sit down, either talk to someone, find out exactly what it is that they want, because it could just be that you're confused and don't know what they want, or you just spend the time to sit down and think about it, you actually feel so much better once you start doing it. Half of what we stress about is, it's just that we haven't taken the time to sit and think of what we need to do. So I can't remember what the original question was, but I'm rambling away. Trust and autonomy, that's my point.
You said something really interesting there, though, Jenny, which I don't think, if you stand back and look at it, and I haven't thought about it in this way until today, when that happened, you know, 20 months ago, and everybody started to work from home, that autonomous piece, you know, people getting up to go and do their job, a lot of people sitting in front of their computers between 9 and 5 or what have you, there was no training really put in place for managers on how to help people to work from home. So we all concentrated on everybody working from home, but not actually the job roles that needed to be done. There was no, all right, so you're a manager of 20 people. Actually, how do we help you manage 20 people remotely, rather than just going, right, can you continue to manage? So what you're going to do as a manager, you're like, well, I'm going to get asked in a month's time about how people are doing at home, if the work's done, how many hours a day they've been working, if timesheets have been completed. So I need to do what I've always done, but I need to do that tenfold because I can't see them. And I actually think it's about looking at the individual job roles and what can be done rather than anything else.
Yeah, and that goes back to what Tim was saying about some of that kind of, like, coffee chat and stuff. I think what I've found hard at points as a freelancer working with clients is, though a lot of my work has been remote for a while, a lot has also been in person. And normally it would at least start with an in-person meeting or a day where I've got that chance to kind of ask lots of questions and things come up. And the thing with the, you know, when you're sat across the table from your manager or across the room, if you've got a little question, you can go and quickly ask them. Whereas when you're remote, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to ring them, I don't want to disturb them. And so you kind of sometimes sit there and stress about something, because to just ask a little question can be quite difficult. So I guess, again, going back to the original thing around digital use of digital, that things like Slack, like, I love Slack, is a great way to kind of ask those little questions as if you're kind of sat across the table. So it's not an email, it's not a phone call, it's just a, like, hey, quick question, is this what I'm meant to be doing, or what, you know? And it's much easier to kind of, because that's the stuff that I think people miss a lot from that in person. It's those quick questions, quick kind of, oh, can you just have a look at this, which seems a much bigger deal when you're at home and having to arrange a meeting for it, or arrange a phone call.
I think that's part of the word you said, which is trust, right? Like if you're proactively, say in an office, if you work in an office, you might ask 6 or 8 of those little things throughout the day. Do you know what I mean? Like if you remove that, like has been the case, people maybe felt they're working alone, like, and it's not, they're not, because you can't sit on Zoom for 8 hours a day, it's ridiculous, right? Like it's a, like they've removed a bunch of stuff, is where all that thing, those things on LinkedIn of people wanting, like tracking your camera, like bugging people, not, I don't know if bugging is the right word, but yeah, tracking, you know, tracking the work, like visibly seeing, like managing people's emails, getting access to people's inboxes, all that stuff, right, is the opposite of trust. Because you, maybe they had the mindset that they mustn't be doing it, right, because I can't physically see them with my eyes, right? And but I think those little communications, those little bits, right, of just going, oh, I'm just doing, like, what colour did you want this in, for example? I remember you said in the meeting, but I can't read my writing. Like, just little things like that build trust, right, build connection, because you're always just nudging the dial in the right direction rather than having one 30-minute thing at the beginning or the end of every day.
Yeah.
Where there's 12 people, you know, I think that building that trust thing has to be a massive part of any, not only happy organization, but also successful one, right? There has to be an element of alignment and trust somewhere in there.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's the ultimate importance of trust. And it's kind of, if you don't trust people, I always ask the question, if you don't trust them, why did you employ them? Like, I know there's something around kind of training people and supporting people, but then part of that trust is trusting that they'll ask you when they're really not sure about something. And so that's one thing I've said to my person who's starting with me next week. She's quite young, and she was like, I just want you to kind of, you know, tell me what you need me to do. And we're going to have a weekly meeting where at the start of the week of kind of what needs doing. But I was like, that's absolutely fine, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you just ask me. Like, no, there's no stupid question. If you're not sure about something, just ask, and it's totally fine. So it kind of goes, that kind of trust goes both ways, I guess. But yeah, it's really important. It has been hard, and what you were saying, Steve, was around my brain's just switched off. What were you saying?
What were you saying, Steve?
Sorry, I
honestly don't know what I was saying. I'm on to my next thought now.
Yeah, okay, let's move on, because I messed that one up.
I've got a quick question just on Agile, Jenny.
Yeah.
So digital practices align quite nicely to Agile, you know, with Trello boards, Kanban, etc. And you look at things like Microsoft Teams and Zoom now, and all the plugins you can get that actually support agile processes. But a lot of organizations don't work on agile, they work on waterfall.
Yeah.
And actually working on waterfall, it can really stagnate digital adoption, because, you know, and it comes back down to that thing where we were talking before. If you work in a silo and you work by yourself on a large-scale project, for example, on a waterfall project, every time you produce something, it then turns into a sales pitch afterwards to get people to buy into it. Yeah. Whereas in Agile, you're not sales pitching, you're co-developing at the same time. Mm-hmm. So do you think that waterfall organizations can work as well digitally, or should waterfall organizations have to adopt agile processes?
So it's a bit of a mix. Like, I'm a big believer that all organizations can be agile, that agile isn't just for digital. And that's something that I'm really passionate about. And I think there are certain things in the workplace that it's very difficult to be agile, but more the kind of real logistical stuff, legal stuff, maybe a bit of HR stuff. But projects, for example, I think any project should and could be agile, at least when it's something new. When it's something that, you know, you do every year, you know exactly what you're doing, then fair enough, you've probably got a plan. But even then, you probably, you know, the world changes, things change, you probably still need to be listening to your customer, you probably still need to be reflecting, learning, editing, changing. So I think agile is for everyone. And in terms of digital adoption in waterfall organizations, I don't know. I mean, I think it's trickier because they'll want to go through some, I mean, I've worked in councils quite a lot, and kind of the process of, oh, we're moving to Office 365 10 years after everyone else moved to it, and this is the 2-year process to make us move to Office 365. And I mean, and that's in organizations where I was doing agile, but that was a separate team and not part of what I do. It is difficult. I'd say the thing that makes it difficult isn't so much the waterfall process, it goes back to autonomy and trust. It's management. That's what makes it difficult. It's sign-off processes. That's what I think is, when I work with organizations on being more agile, it's senior leaders that are the blockers. It's sign-off, it's process, it's the lack of trust. That is what stops things moving faster. That's what stops things being agile. And that's the hardest thing to change. It should in some ways be the easiest, but it's not. It's often
culture, isn't it? Culture
change. Culture, yeah, exactly. It's all about culture change. And it's, yeah, people get really excited about agile and they're like, yeah, we're gonna do it. And then when it's like, so you've got to kind of trust your teams to get on with, oh, you mean I'm not going to be able to sign everything off? And no, I don't know if I can do that. And people get a bit anxious about it because that's what they're used to. It's like going back to, say, when you were talking about how people used to do what their parents did, it's kind of they do what their managers did. And it's like, well, I'm a senior manager now, so I should have the powers that the last senior manager had. And it's kind of, it's not about power. It's about support and collaboration and... yeah, it's just a completely different dynamic. And I think young people coming into the workforce now, more and more of them want that and need that. And they're going to continue to kind of rebel against the kind of old traditional hierarchical way of working. I don't think it'll ever go completely. And as you said, in certain jobs, like job titles and showing, you know, where you are can be quite important. But I hope and think we are going to see more and more organizations that are less hierarchical, that allow things to be more agile, because we have to be. I mean, as you've said, technology is changing and it's going to continue to change, and that changes everything. And you know, I mean, if there's one thing the pandemic has done, it's made all organizations have to be agile. They've had to adapt quickly to new things. And you know, organizations, oh no, we don't want people working from home, no, they won't do any work. They've had to work from home, they've had no choice. And so it's definitely kind of shown and proven that things can be done quickly, change can happen quickly without all the big long waterfall processes. But I had a conversation with a charity chief exec a while ago, and they were really keen on bringing kind of agile processes in. And they were saying that they'd been really agile during the pandemic, but all the old ways were starting to creep in. And I guess that her example was, it's not just the managers. It was kind of people are like waiting to be told or wanting the processes back in place. And yeah, so it's interesting. It'd be interesting to see where we are in a year, like if organizations are still quite agile, or if everything kind of, is everyone going to go back to working in the office full time? Or I don't know.
It's an interesting thing within that's happening at the moment. Like, we, over the last couple of years of the podcast, we spoke about, me and Steve, quite a lot about, it feels like there's change in the air, right? There's opportunity for change now, but all right, a lot of it's been forced and not by choice, or expedited a little bit through, we needed to, right? Because a lot of things change, but in the work. But I think it comes that, like, to create a happier organization, right? A more solve a productivity problem, whatever the challenge is. It's often the root cause is behavior change, right? And people change. So before this call, I was in a meeting with a company, quite a decent company, like 100 people, right, who have a problem, and they're trying to become carbon neutral / negative, right? So they bought out of the, they have 25 people with company cars, for example. So this year they gave everybody hybrid cars, right? But they've got a fleet, so they've got fleet management and tracking systems, blah, 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 blah. Like, just because it's part of managing a fleet effectively. But they have an issue, right, that the people haven't changed it. They've got a new car, they've got a tax break, right? It looks good on paper that the company has made this positive change, right? But nobody's charging them. Like, they just use the petrol bit of the car. And that is now a negative effect because they've got a 300 kilogram battery in it, which makes it really less fuel efficient, right? So they've done, in theory, a good change. Like, oh, we're going to bring Slack in so we can all communicate. But then the behavior hasn't changed, right? They've changed the technology, right, for it in the loosest possible world. But it's the behavior change that organizations have to work on, and then they can make that change easier and more effective, probably by using digital teams. But it's always that people thing. Sorry, Steve, what were you going to say?
You're completely right. What they've done is focused on the tool to change rather than the culture for change. And that's why it hasn't happened. You've got to get people. People will always take a new car. You know, that's a given. You want to give me a new car for work? That's great. But actually, what you're expecting from me when I get this new car, that's the bit that you've got to drive underneath.
Yeah, and it's that kind of change curve of kind of you've got to get those few kind of pioneers that are doing it and kind of talking about it. And it's the same with kind of agile change, or I guess anything, of like, you've just got to get a few people. It's got to kind of start from the bottom of people kind of doing it, seeing the benefits of it, and then sharing it. And then suddenly, like, hopefully everyone takes off and becomes part of it. The other thing is, they should have just got electric cars and not bothered with hybrid.
Yeah.
I've just got an electric car. Kudos to me. Points to Jenny.
Big kudos.
And I looked into hybrids, and I was like, I knew that if I got a hybrid, I'd probably do the same. Because it's like, it's easier. We often take the easy option. And with an electric car, like, I've just been to Wales for a week, and it is a bit of a faff charging it. It can be, every blooming charging point is different. You've got to download a new app, and sometimes they don't work. And there's a lot of things that are a bit of a pain in the ass, but I didn't have a choice. So I kind of had to deal with it. If I'd have had a hybrid car, I probably would have charged it up, used what electric was there, and then just filled it with petrol for the rest of the holiday.
They're stuck now as well, right, on that thing. So their option, one of the options that they thought of was, well, if we make everybody electric, they have to charge it, right, which is more stick than carrot. Or the other stick, not carrot, is, well, we'll take hybrid option off them, which will cost them 20% more in tax every year, right? Because there's a tax thing for having a hybrid car, right? Both are pretty big sticks. Like, nobody wants 20% more tax ever. Like, it's not a thing, right? A few grand is a few grand, right? But they're looking to build this. They were like, what can we do to incentivize them to use the thing? I was like, well, you know, in an ideal world, if they were working in an agile or human-centered way or co-creative way or collaborative way, these people would have been bought in at the beginning when the decision's been made, not just go, hey, we're changing your car. Mm. It's going to be hybrid.
Exactly.
Because we're being carbon neutral. And they're like, all right, sure. It still works, though, without the plugging in, right? Like, you know, which is not the thing, but they weren't bought in to the project because they didn't have that. They weren't part of the development or design or decision-making process.
And that's exactly the same with when you're bringing in kind of agile working, is if the chief exec or director or whatever comes along and is like, right, everyone, we're now going to be agile. People are going to be like, whoa, what? No, you've got to bring them along from the start, and you've got to get those few pioneers that are starting it, and then people start to see those benefits, hopefully. So when I was working in a council a couple of years ago, I can't believe it was a couple of years ago. Where's the last 2 years gone? I was brought in to kind of help embed agile working in the digital teams. There was two teams I was working with. And so we were working on agile. We had the Kanban board on the wall in this kind of, it was kind of like a room that was also a walkway that everyone walked through when they came in the morning. And so people started to kind of think, oh, what's that? And then you'd see people meeting at 9 a.m. for the stand up, and everyone's like, oh, why has everyone stood around that board? And other people start to see it. And then I'd started doing some kind of lunch and learn sessions that anyone could come to. And then I was only there a few months, but by the end, by the time I left, the HR team, I use them as an example of not agile, and they weren't fully agile, but they were using bits. They had a Kanban board and they were doing morning stand-ups, and so were other teams. It was kind of like they'd seen it and they were like, oh, what's happening? That's interesting. And then they'd hear the team talking about it, saying, oh, you know, positively, and they wanted to find out more, and then they started using bits themselves. So it's that kind of knock-on effect. You've got to start small and kind of let people decide for themselves whether they want to do it or not, and not just make it this is what we're doing now. It's the same with everything, isn't it? It's the same with now, again, organizations that have been really good of kind of asking people, do you want to come back to the office? Do you want to stay working from home? Like, what kind of mix? How can we make this work hybrid? Whereas organizations that have been like, right, now you can work from home maximum of 2 days a week, you've got to be in the office the rest of the time, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's different for everyone. So I think it's tough now, I'd imagine, as a director of a company. Not that it's ever not tough, but I'd imagine you have got to take more people's opinions into you've got to listen to more people. You've probably got to have different options. But if you want people to be happy at work, there will be differences. There are going to be exceptions. And it's like if you take working parents, some parents have loved being at home and having that flexibility with their kids. Others have actually hated it. And they're like, I need to get back to the office and not be a parent and be out of the house and not be, you know, so everyone's different. And it's difficult, I think, to please everyone. And maybe you're never going to please everyone, but you have got to try and listen and adapt.
I still believe change is in the air, and it's like if you needed a push to make a change or a switch in direction, it still feels like the right space in time to do that sort of thing. So
yeah,
I think to kind of summarize all the bits we've been talking about today, all the things, right? I think we're starting to make like an ingredients list of a happiness workplace, right? That people need to feel joy at work, or whatever that the right phrase for that is, right? So there's trust and autonomy, which we've discussed at length, right? They're the two non-negotiable things. But what would be, in your experience, like other ingredients that if people were looking for a kind of a checklist of how to make a workplace happier, what would be the other ingredients, do you think?
So yeah, there's trust and autonomy, there's listening, there's making listening and acting, not just listening and ignoring. I think there's also, you want trust and autonomy, but also I think people need direction and goals. So you want to know that if you're working as part of a team, as part of an organization, that you are actually all working towards that same goal. And that's one thing. So again, with Agile, if we think of Scrum and the different kind of ceremonies, as they call them, like the review, so the sprint review. So at the end of each sprint, the team might come together and do a review, but that review is meant to be open to kind of anyone and everyone could come and see what the team has been up to over the last couple of weeks or however long. And hopefully you can link that back to kind of how this helps other teams or other people in the organization. And you start to kind of see how you're a cog in this machine, but you're needed as much as everyone else, and kind of seeing that you're all working towards those same goals, I think is really important. Otherwise you get siloed teams, you get people getting angry, you get people thinking that their work is always the priority, and like actually you need all those different people to make the thing happen, to make the business run, whatever their role is. So I think that kind of overarching goal and focus is really important. What else? I mean, there's lots of stuff. There's obviously all the kind of typical well-being stuff of kind of looking after people, seeing what's happening in the rest of their life. It's not for everyone, but I'm a very much bring your whole self to work kind of person. I am who I am at work as I am who I am out of work. It's all one and the same thing. And to some people that's really important, but to others actually they don't want to. They like to keep the two quite separate. So listening to what's important to people and what they want to bring is really important. And I guess understanding the differences of we are all different and making sure that you're not, it can be very easy in like a really often in the kind of like closest cultures that you get people that feel left out if they don't feel, I don't know, if everything's always about drinking and they don't drink, or there's lots of those kind of examples of why do all the staff parties have to be in the evening? I've got kids, how about we have a lunchtime one? Or just making sure you're inclusive in all different ways is really, really important. There's probably other things off the top of my head. That's how's the toolkit looking? We've got a few things on there.
It's a good toolkit. Ingredients. It's a good toolkit. Go on, Tim.
No, you go, dude.
So we've got trust and autonomy, listening and acting, direction and goals, well-being, and then understand the differences that we're all different.
Mm. Yeah, inclusivity, yeah. Right? That's because if we were to give those, you probably do, and feel good, do good, right? You probably get, like, these are the areas that we need to optimise to create a happier workplace, right? They are super personalised, right? Like, people can go, okay, how does our organisation build trust? How do we build trust in these teams that we've got? Not that, just how you build trust in an engineering company may be different than a charity. Because context and you've got different skills, maybe different personality types. Do you know what I mean? There's the personality of that company is maybe different than the thing. So how they build trust, how they work towards direction and goals. You know, a charity might have be driven by a just cause or a purpose, whereas manufacturing and engineering is maybe a productivity level or outputs, right?
It's different for everyone, and it goes back to that listening and acting of like what works for your organization. Like some organizations might have the kind of culture where actually everyone loves a kind of lunchtime yoga session or a lunchtime positive psychology session or all these kind of fun well-being activities, let's do an art class together or whatever, whereas for other places or people within a place they're like, no effing way, I don't want to do an art class on my lunch break. And actually all they want is, so one thing that a lot of organizations have done, which I think is really good, is having like the hour of no meetings or 2-hour lunch period where you're never allowed to book in meetings 12 till 2, for example, to make sure that people take their lunch in that time. And amazing how many people I work with are so bad at doing that. They're like, oh no, sorry, I'm fully booked from 8:30 in the morning till 6 p.m. on Zoom calls, and I can't even squeeze you in for a 10-minute call. It's back to back. And that's not healthy for anyone. And I think Again, with kind of the online calls, it can be more tiring, and I think we almost need more time off. My final thing that I'm just going to add to the toolkit, which is, again, I'm not great at it myself, but my aim a while ago, which I got worse at during the pandemic, was the 4-day work week. If we're in the creative world, office world, I think most people could manage a 4-day work week. I'm a big advocate for a 3-day weekend. We procrastinate a lot. One of the biggest things that makes me happy is when I've had a productive day, and I would rather squeeze, you know, have productive days and squeeze my work into 4 days and procrastinate less and have a longer weekend than, spreading things out and faffing about and wasting time. And I think most people that do office jobs could do them in 4 days.
It's very political at the moment, isn't it? The 4-day week with the SNP starting to put that in their manifesto. Do you think it's something that will head to Wales and England and Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it won't be for every organisation. It won't work. It doesn't work for a lot of jobs. I mean, people that work in hospitality or NHS
retail.
There's a lot of things where it is harder, but I think for office type jobs, I think it will become more and more common. And similarly to the working from home, I think it'll be the flexibility, it will become a pull and a kind of requirement for a lot of young people coming into the workplace. I think people having side hustles and freelance projects and doing multiple things is only going to get bigger. The freelance world is growing all the time. So I think kind of either part-time jobs or full-time jobs in 4 days is, I think, going to become, a bigger thing. Whether it'll become law in terms of you have to give people that exact kind of flexibility, I don't know. But it is changing, isn't it, around people being allowed to ask for flexible working.
Yeah, I mean, the law is there, isn't it, for flexible working now? Is you've got to be able to, as a company, you've got to be able to disprove that you can't be flexible in that
exactly.
job role, rather than people having to request, can I be flexible?
I would
much rather work 8 to 8 over 4 days, for example. If people are still defining contracted hours, then if you need to do 30, 35, 40, whatever it is, if you could define, I'll do that, 8 to 8 on Monday to Thursday, and I'll take a Friday off.
I think it's great. I think it's just, again, part of the manager's role of making sure that people aren't working into the night because they procrastinated during the day, so they're feeling guilty and their hours become, I mean, if that works for people, fine, but I think it can almost have the opposite effect, can't it, if people end up working even more because they're like, I don't know, it's
it opens up a whole other hour conversation again about what is a manager, or is a manager a leader, but that's for another time.
I was going to say the same sort of thing, actually, like this, not to open a whole nother conversation at this point of the podcast, but there's things like a guy called Dan Sullivan in the States invented a thing called the entrepreneurial time system, which is you make up your days, right? You make up your month or your year from 3 days where you don't do any work stuff. Focus days, which is the stuff you get paid for, and buffer days, which is the stuff you don't get paid for, like answering emails and thinking of things. Like, the paper that he says, like, he's a real famous business coach, and he's employed that in some pretty successful, pretty large businesses over in the States, and found it to be super productive if everybody focuses on those. So in your 5-day week, right, in your week, sorry, you've got to have 3 free days, 2 buffer days, and 2 focus days or something, right? So it's up to you when you have them, because it's you, right? And these might change. You might want a 3-day on your daughter's birthday, for example, or prom. Do you know what I mean? Like, that changes around. But the important is to have that separation, right? To have that sort of thing in your mind as that flexibility, and trust that you will do your job regardless of your flexibility.
Yeah, no, I like that.
That makes a A good point. But I think we've reached a critical point or a fundamental finish before we open that doorway or go down any of the forks in the conversation. But we've probably had a good chat about organisational happiness and the work you do and the relationship. So thank you very much, Jenny. Any final comments before we let Jenny share where she people can get hold of a Steve-O?
I think we could carry on for another couple of hours. Can we carry on for another couple of hours?
I can't. I'm back to back with Tim, unfortunately.
Well, you should have a buffer day in there, Tim, shouldn't you? No, I found it super insightful, especially actually everything leads back to culture.
Yeah.
Everything comes back to culture. It's not about the tools. It's not about the outputs. It's all about the culture.
It is.
So that's one thing I'm definitely going to take away today.
Awesome. So, Jen, say let people know where they can get hold of you, where the best place to connect to all of your things are, and I will put them in the show notes also.
This is, where I never know what to say because there's too many things. But I'm Feel Good, Do Good. The best place is probably the websites, and then from the websites you can find the social media. But feelgooddogood.co.uk and coworkingcorner.co. Are the two main places. And one thing I haven't talked about at all, which I forgot in my introduction, is I'm also a travel blogger. So I have a travel blog called She Gets Around. I've just come back from a luxury cruise around the Med. So I will be writing about that soon, just to add a slight side separate thing.
I included it in the introduction of list of stuff Jenny does.
Okay, cool. I'm Jay Lothrop on Twitter and Instagram, which is the just me one as opposed to the business branded ones. So
awesome,
here, there and everywhere. I'm online, you'll find me.
You'll find it. She's connected. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes and links to all the things so you can browse freely through Jenny's work life. But thank you very much, Jen, for coming on. We really appreciate it. This show was brought to you by Bang.io, which you can find in the link in the bio. But otherwise, we're done for the day. Thank you very much, people.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye.